Thanks, Steve. Hi, everybody. It's us. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Welcome to the show. Can I start off with a quick correction, Wendy? During the crosstalk, I mentioned that one of our guests, Mike Pesca, has written a book called We're Much Funnier Than We Used to Be. That's incorrect. He wrote an article, and I should know because I read the article, called We're Much, Much Funnier Than We Used to Be. So he'll be on to explain it. And the timing on this is great. I will explain why. Did you ever laugh at something, even though we're adults, did you ever laugh at something and as it's amusing you, as you're laughing at it, you realize this is meant for a nine-year-old. Why do I find this so enjoyable?
Because that's the innocence of something funny. Seriously.
It's ageless.
Yeah.
It could be whenever, right? Yesterday, as I'm leaving this building, there's a guy in sales, Brad Furay, who you know, very, very nice guy. So Brad is entering the building as I'm leaving the building, and he gets into the revolving door, and then he does a bit for me where he doesn't realize that the way a revolving door works is you get in on one side, you push it a couple of steps, and then you get out on the other side. So he just keeps going around in the revolving door, which
That's
makes me laugh
funny.
Very hard. Because it's so stupid. And all I could think of was, I'm glad this is happening at an off time where there's not a line of people behind him or other people in the revolving door, because I know they wouldn't find it anywhere near as amusing as I did.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah.
If it was someone you didn't know, if it wasn't Brad Furay, would you have thought it was funny? Or would
I would
have
laughed
said, come
more.
On, clown.
I would have laughed more because I would think that I know Brad. I know he was doing it to make me laugh.
You're sure of that, right?
Oh, no, I'm not, Steve, to be honest with you.
But then, I know Brad.
Every time he got to the part where he should get off, he looked more dejected, like, why can't I figure this out? It was a beautiful piece of work, is what it was.
Well, do they have those kind of doors in other countries?
Revolving doors?
Because sometimes I see people on them, and maybe they're tourists or what, you know, from somewhere else, and they really don't know what to do. And it's kind of like, God, I feel so bad, because it's like, okay, come on.
I know for a fact, Mary, and I've brought this up before, after you leave this building, to get where the parking lot is that I go to, it's a couple blocks away, you have to go down two flights of steps. It's outside, so it's an outside staircase that's two flights high, and whenever there's people from another foreign land, they don't understand that you stay to the right.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
If there's
because
no one,
they drive on the left.
I know.
Or they drive on the right.
I know.
Yeah.
But don't you have to follow the rules of whatever country you're in at that moment, not where you came from?
Yeah, but if they don't know. There's not a sign that says, you know, keep to the right.
I guess.
Pass on the left.
I guess.
Just stay in the middle, people. That's what you should
do.
Aren't revolving doors weather related?
I think so.
So if you're in a mild climate,
you might not have any revolving doors.
I didn't know they were weather related.
Well, they keep the cold out or they keep the heat out. You know, it's not like you're opening a door every time someone's coming in or out.
Right.
Wow,
right.
I never realized that. I have a lot of apprehension about getting in a revolving door.
Because why?
Because timing is everything. And it's like, do you go right away? Do you leave a blank one before you jump
in? No, there's no time for a blank space.
See, I like to leave a buffer between the person coming out and the person coming in.
Because what? What would
I just
that do?
Feel like you'll run into each other. And I always do like a stutter step, like, should I go in this one? Wait, I'll wait for the next one.
I think there's a lot of wasted space. I like to get in a square with someone.
Oh, that's...
And God, I hate when people do that.
Involved with them.
It's well, it's some
expedite
places...
Expedite the process.
I always see this in hospitals and sometimes in airline terminals. It's not a revolving door that's meant for one. It's meant for three or four or five.
Oh, yeah. And it moves by itself very slowly.
Very slowly.
Those I kind of like.
Yeah.
Because there's room.
Right. A lot more room.
I am a little claustrophobic. I'm a lot anxious.
Yeah, because what if it gets stuck all of a sudden in the middle?
And you're trapped in
Bill
there.
Bill would laugh at you.
I would laugh for a long time
funny.
If I saw that.
Is there air
Mary.
Holes in there?
You
air
would not
pockets?
Suffocate.
Wait, Mary, I'm looking at the statistics for deaths and revolving doors, and once again, the number zero. We pulled it off again.
Well, escalators are a hazard sometimes. You've got to
be
careful. You
could get trapped on those.
Yeah. Why is it when an escalator is out of order and you walk up it or walk down it?
Yeah.
It is very confusing
dizzying.
For your brain. Yes. Is
very
it because
dizzying.
Of all the lines? Is it because the steps are bigger than a traditional step on a stairway? Because every time
they're
out of
levels.
Order, it's like I feel like Herman Munster walking. Bum, bum,
it's
bum.
A combination, I think, of the pattern, right?
Yeah.
Right? Because the lines kind of blend into the horizontal and the vertical kind of blend
yeah,
together.
Yeah, right.
so there's very little separation. And you're right, the stairs are not like they'd be on a staircase.
They're
elongated.
Steeper or yeah. something, yeah.
Well, I guess they would be steeper a little bit, right?
It's a bigger step.
Yeah.
And then it gets shorter as you go get up to the top, and then you start, like, tripping over yourself.
Do well, you really turn into a loaf of bread if you get caught in it?
Yes, instantly.
My grandpa's shoe got caught in one once.
Oh, no.
Did he live to tell the tale?
He was fine, but he was missing a shoe for the rest of the trip.
Really?
Yeah, it was stuck in there.
Oh.
This is the story I hear from the family, you know.
There is an element of fear. I remember when I was a kid, when we would come downtown for Christmas and we would go to Marshall Fields, those were very imposing looking escalators.
Well,
you know,
you're little,
friendlier.
Then.
Yeah, of course. Of course. When you were a kid, did you do the thing where you would stand at the top and you would move the handrail
yep.
along? Why is that fun?
Because you, in your mind, you're like, yes, I'm the one that's keeping this going.
Right.
You just kind of keep moving the band
yes.
that is the handrail.
And it's a tough task. You're providing a service.
Or you wanted to sit on the handrail.
That I never did.
Yeah.
Did you go, if it was one going up, did you walk down
yes,
it or down
it
going
was pretty
up?
Fun.
That's amazing. That's a good time.
That's a good workout. I know you hate when people stand on an escalator,
yes.
but what if they're going the opposite
that
way? Would that bug you?
No, that's fine then.
And if they're from another country where they drive on the left, it would be mayhem.
Right. All hell would break loose at that point.
Well, I'm glad Brad Foray made you laugh.
Oh, he made me laugh so hard.
But wait a minute. I'm confused because we're much funnier than we used to be. That's a reversal of funny.
Yes, it is.
So I don't understand.
That's the article I'm writing, Wendy, called Reversal of Funny. Where things that were once funny are no longer funny because we've matured.
We all have a 10-year-old boy in ourselves,
I could have watched him do this for 20 minutes. It would have amused me easily for 20 minutes.
Is he still down there?
He's still down there. He can't get out.
I'm telling you, and I think Bertrand agrees, if that would have been someone you didn't know, it wouldn't have been so funny.
No, I'm telling you, it would have made me laugh even harder because I would, in my head, I'm like, is he doing this to be funny or is he legitimately trapped and not know how to get out of a revolving door? At some point, somebody would have come to his aid. Not necessarily me.
Who comes to your aid?
Well, their building security would have come and said, sir, is there a way that I can help you to get out of that revolving door?
How
you
do you talk
do all
to
day.
Him, though? Just when it comes around,
they
hey,
would only hear it.
Sir.
They'd hear it a quarter of the time.
You
right.
need.
You'd have to pace yourself.
Help.
You couldn't do it all in one burst.
Do ya?
Right. Or you would just draw a picture of an arrow and point at the open slot. Come on, get out. You can get out. We can do this.
We had
an excuse
funnier.
For being
right.
late for work.
Right, right.
No, it is not.
Trapped
That's
in the revolving
the
door. I couldn't do anything. All right, we'll take a break. Jared Payton will join us to talk Bears football. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Chicago Bears. Jared Payton is on the telephone. Hey, Jared.
What's up, guys? That was awesome, Wendy. Thank you very much.
Wendy's been working on that for 3 years. She finally unveiled it.
She is the best, man. Yep. You can just sit out for this one.
Yep.
Go ahead, Wendy.
All right, let's talk Bears. Bill, we got to suck you back into being a Bears fan. Sunday football, it's happening. What do you got for us, Jarrett?
Well, this is going to be a big test. I have the honor of going to D.C. Over the weekend and watching a Bears team, and we talked about it, that needed to get a win and also needed to get some confidence. Mitchell Trubisky needed some confidence, and we knew that the defense was really good, but they got some big confidence with some takeaways. So now, after you see a team that was doing what they were supposed to do against a bad Skins team, now they have a chance to go up against a Minnesota team, a division foe, and it's not going to be easy. So now my biggest thing is looking to see how this all carries over from Monday Night Football and the high that this team is on and the game that Matt Nagy called. Can they duplicate that against a good Vikings team? And I don't know. It's something that we'll have to see on Sunday.
It did get a little dicey toward the end of the game for a bit, though. You have to admit, right?
Yeah, it did, but this is what happens. Especially with the way that Chuck Pagano was calling the game, these guys had their ears pinned back, and they were going after the quarterback, after Case Keenum, and, you know, they get us a lot of energy. And I was there early on in the game, and I got to D.C., and I'm like, man, it's hot here. It's humid. And those guys starting the game, it was a little humid out. So as the process went on, they were exuding a lot of energy early on, and then you could see at the end of the game what they were just trying to do. Guys were tired, So they were starting playing a little bit more zone, and they were just trying not to get beat over the top, and they didn't want any long passes. So, but when the defense needed to make a play, they did make a play, and I think that's what makes this team so interesting, is that if the offense could put up points early on in games, it would give this defense an opportunity to truly just, like, go after quarterbacks, and that's what I'm waiting to see. If they can put up some points early in games, this Bears defense is going to be able to set them up for success down the line.
You said Mitch Trubisky needs to build up his confidence. Do you think I know we won, but do you still think that game gave him the confidence he needs to move forward?
Wendy, I hope so. I mean, I'm hoping it's something. It's the start of something great. I mean, anytime when you're playing, when I was playing, anytime that you could go up against an opponent that you're supposed to beat, and you can start feeling, you know, a little bit better about yourself, and it was hard. Everybody always says that they don't read the newspapers or they don't look at social media. When I was playing, it was hard not to. Like, you have to look. And for me, a lot of times when I was playing in Canada in the CFL, they had two papers. They had a French paper, and then they had also American paper. So sometimes they would talk about me in French really bad. Trubisky here in Chicago, he knows. He sees what's going on. He hears what's going on. I think this gave him confidence, but also, too, and I believe his confidence never wavers. I think the confidence of the Bears fans and the media, and then also people in the national media, it wavers for them a little bit. So I'm hoping that game gave him a little bit more kind of pushback, a little bit from the haters out there that are at his heels right now.
Jared, Kyle Long has a new entry on his IMDb page. Your thoughts?
I now know why his name is Kyle Long.
That is...
Should they be streaming?
Listen, no, that's one thing. And listen, Tariq Cohen yesterday talked about it. He said, you know, he felt bad about it. Kyle Long, he laughed about it and was like, you know, they're teammates. He knew that Tariq Cohen didn't mean to do that. But, you know, in this day and age, man, you can't be live streaming in the locker room when your buddies are getting out of the shower, about to get into the shower. You know, you gotta keep it, wait till you get out on the bus. Then you can do that stuff.
For those of you who don't know, Tariq Cohen feels bad and is apologetic and embarrassed, quote unquote, about accidentally showing teammate Kyle Long naked in front of his locker during a video live stream on Instagram. This was after Monday's win.
You know, it explains Coach Nagy singing the national anthem at Wrigley Field.
You've been waiting for that for months.
Do we have that, Jasmine?
Bears head coach Matt Nagy.
Yep, it all makes sense now, doesn't it?
that was like perfect timing to bring that back this week.
That's how Bill Love operates. You
Sometimes
know that
you
by
lay
now.
Low in the weeds, you just wait.
Don't
That's all you
say
can
that.
Do. I just hope I never. Oh man, there's probably something out there you can get me on too. You know what? I'll be nice to you, Bill. Take you to lunch next week.
All right, thank
He's
you.
He's got a dark side, Jarrett. You know that.
Eddie Pinheiro, let's be honest. He went from kind of an unknown quantity to all of a sudden he's one of the Bears' heroes. That happened fast, didn't it, Jarrett?
It happened super fast, and credit to him. And I got to say, this young man went through a lot through this process to be able to get the kicking job for the Bears. And it wasn't easy, but he has shown, though, that for early on in this season that he can be dependable. And, you know, when the offense was struggling, he was the one that was putting up points. So this is what you want to see out of your guy. And a lot of the biggest question marks and the biggest question mark heading into the season was, do we have the kicker? And now it looks like it. And so over time, I think we'll get a chance to really see him. But now I think he can feel comfortable in his own skin, and he can also just kind of be that guy that can do his thing, but his knee being kind of messed up a little bit in D.C. You could tell, hobbling a little bit, and that's his kicking leg that is the knee that's hurt. So hopefully he can kind of get that thing right. It's hard to do as the season goes on. You got to practice. You got to walk on it. So that's going to be interesting to watch as we go forward.
Chicago Bears, Minnesota Vikings, predictions, Jarrett? Boy, it's so hard.
It's tough. I just being inside of that Bears locker room, I don't have a score yet. I believe in my heart it's going to be a tough game. Dalvin Cook, the running back from the Vikings, they got a good running game going. Their defense is stout. I just feel like listening to Danny Trevathan yesterday, the Bears linebacker, that the Bears are really good against the run. So I just have a feeling the Bears are going to get their first win of the season at home. And I think it's going to be this Sunday. I don't have a score yet, but I just have a feeling they're going to get the W. So that's always good.
Jared, one quick question also about the competition, about the Green Bay Packers. They play tonight in Thursday Night Football. Are you surprised that it's the Packers' defense that's pulling that team instead of their offense?
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, but that's always been the case, is that Aaron Rodgers is always, anytime he's on the football field, it's kind of scary. The defense now being better, that right there definitely should scare Bears fans just a little bit, because that's going to make them, with the offense is going to start clicking, and that's going to be the scary part. And if defense can do that, they're going to be one of those teams in the division you got to be able to look at.
I'm feeling hopeful. I'm glad the Bears are back to their Sunday games. I like it.
Yeah, me too. My family's excited too. At least I get to be home for the weekend. I'm excited about that.
Well, go Bears. That's all I got to say at this point, Jarrett, and we'll recap next week.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jarrett.
Your timing is impeccable. Can I just tell you that?
No one knew what it meant when he sang that song at Wrigley Field a few months ago, but now it all fits. It all falls into place now, doesn't it?
Listeners, co-workers, be very careful, because Bill Leff will remember your worst moment and bring it back to haunt
you. Sure, of course. That's why it's fun. All right, we'll take a quick break.
Actually, there is no break.
There's no break.
This is a fun break. Let's do it this way. We have a pair of tickets to give away to Silver Creek Rock and Brew Fest. Do you like beer? Do you like live music? It's happening Sunday, October 27th from 3 to 7. Enjoy over 20 local breweries, and you get some live music from Elton John and Tom Petty tribute bands. I guess they couldn't afford to get Elton John, and Tom Petty no longer with us.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting that. You can get your tickets at Ticketmaster.com. Rockin' Brew Fest, it's happening October 27th at Four Winds Casino, New Buffalo. Since it's Four Winds Casino, let's take caller number 4. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Fourth caller gets a pair of tickets to the Silver Creek Rockin' Brew Fest.
While we're waiting for that winner, Wendy, we were discussing earlier revolving doors, and the consensus of opinion was they are somehow weather-related, that the revolving door was...
Well, that's what Bertrand said.
And who are we to quibble with Steve Bertrand?
Yeah, right.
Well, there was an old wives' tale that said that they originally came to be so horses wouldn't enter buildings.
Really?
But it turns out...
is that still an issue? Is that still something we should be looking at?
No, they actually were invented because many advantages compared to traditional hinge doors. For example, revolving doors are more energy efficient than regular doors. Ding, ding, ding to Bertrand.
Then why don't we have them in our homes?
How do you lock them?
I think that would be your problem right there.
They also limit the amount of air that escapes as the wings rotate through the cylinder, so drafts are reduced, heating and cooling costs are minimized, and as I told you off the air, they allow more people to enter and exit buildings more quickly, because if you just have one door and you're opening it, not a lot of people can get through.
Right.
More revolving door fascinating facts. We'll discuss them maybe on the stream.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Did you notice that they're heavier than they used to be?
No.
I know I'm not imagining that, because as I'm bigger and stronger than ever, Wendy, I've noticed that the doors take a lot more pushing to get any progress.
I think you're right.
There's no doubt.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
I let the person in front of me push all the time, so I really don't know.
Because you're a lady.
That is a manly thing if you guys push the door for us.
Yeah.
And they do fold together to... let people out. So if Brad would have gotten stuck in there, they just kind of fold together, and then there's a route on each side
to
get
escape route on the revolving door. I didn't know
they're
that.
Foolproof.
That's how they bring the bodies out after tragic accidents.
Congratulations to Darla. Darla has called us from Hennepin, and she is heading over to New Buffalo, Four Winds Casino, New Buffalo, for the Silver Creek Rock and Brew Fest. It's happening Sunday, October 27th. 20 local breweries, lots of beer, lots of live music from Elton John and Tom Petty tribute bands. We have more tickets to give away throughout the rest of the week. You can get your tickets at Ticketmaster.com.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Mike Pesca. Mike is a journalist. He writes for Slate Magazine. He does some great work over there at Slate Magazine. He's the host of a daily podcast called The Gist, and he's just written a fascinating article called We're Much, Much Funnier Than We Used to Be. Mike, I hope that's true. Is it true?
Yeah, I am. I think you guys are. I've been listening for a couple years.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It just seems like it.
All right, let's start at the very beginning. I think you started out your story talking about the Muppets, which makes sense, and how the Muppets have changed over the years. Take it away, Mike. What did you find?
So I got a DVD set of the first year of The Muppet Show, and I was excited to watch because I remembered The Muppets being fun and funny as a kid. Now, this was season one of The Muppets, and there were hits and misses, but what struck me was that the misses were so bad. There was this ongoing sketch called At the Dance where two Muppets would make jokes, but often the jokes weren't even bad jokes or jokes that didn't land. They were non-jokes and not of the current we're trying to be weird for some reason type non-jokes. And it just struck me that, oh my God, this show or a show of that quality or jokes of that quality could never happen now. Every single TV writer is just better than a slew of those jokes. And it turns out that actually Jim Henson recognized that problem, and he fought with the network to get that writer, the main writer, fired off the show. But the fact is, the network was saying, this is a comedy writer. You have to have him writing these jokes. And so it did occur to me that this wasn't just in isolation. I remembered some of the TV shows of my youth, and maybe things like Gilligan's Island or Bewitched were a little broad. But if you went into comedies like the Sonny and Cher show, or when they broke up, just Sonny and just Cher, you cannot. I know variety shows aren't supposed to be cutting-edge comedy, but they were so bad. They were just non-comedy, the kind of non-comedy where just barely, it wouldn't exist today because the lowest writer on the comedy rung would be 10 times as good as these Sonny and Cher writers. And I guess the audience is also implicated, right? If were laughing at it, they did it. If people laughed at Bob Hope's specials, it wasn't just because Bob Hope was fooling them. They thought it was funny.
Yeah.
I thought Hee-Haw was funny. Now, come on, Mike.
I thought, you know, there is a great kind of corny humor that transcends everything, and that especially those jokes in the corn patch, but they were actual jokes. My point is more that we used to have, if you look at old TV schedules, 1973, 1974, I went back, there were a couple nights a week without one sitcom, without one variety show trying to be funny. And so this means, and that was the only place to ever get humor, mass humor. You could, I guess, read an S.J. Perlman book or something. So you could sit at home and have, most Americans would sit at home and have zero access to professional humor on a night or two of the week.
Yeah.
That is inconceivable now. So we've kind of trained Americans to be funnier just by the sheer inundation of humor. And I see it. I don't walk down the street cracking up left and right. But just the regular person who's cracking a regular joke, the jokes are better, and professional comedy got better, too.
Mike, as I read your article, I thought The Muppets was a great starting point. But then in my head, I'm running other shows, and I'll use The Simpsons as a great example because consistently The Simpsons has been one of the funniest shows for two decades. But if you watch that first season or the first two or maybe even three seasons, the pacing was so different. It wasn't like it is now where you're just barraged with humor and jokes. There was a lot of downtime between those jokes.
Right. And The Simpsons came out of the gate. I guess they had to redo. They didn't recast Homer's voice, but they redid Homer's voice, and that made a big change. But after The Simpsons hit its stride, and some say season three or four is the best season of sitcom writing ever, all these people who were at home loving The Simpsons then go on to create their own shows, sometimes very much like The Simpsons. So you have Family Guy, and you have later on shows like Rick and Morty and Adult Swim, and these are like children of the Simpsons, but there's an arms race. So as they get more daring and more comedic and the cutaway jokes come faster and more furious, The Simpsons up their game, and we're training ourselves to have less hand-holding, less setups. You're absolutely right with the pace. The jokes can come a mile a minute. I mean, think about when Airplane came out in 1980 and no one had ever seen anything like it. I just rewatched, actually, Airplane 2. And in terms of, I used to think that was the densest thing I've ever seen in jokes per minute.
Yep.
Compared to most shows, most of the good shows on Cartoon Network or Adult Swim, fewer jokes per minute in Airplane than just exist on 12 different shows right now on TV.
All right, you had mentioned something in your article, which if we could go back to 1967, The Monkees won the Emmy for Best Comedy Series, beating out the Andy Griffith Show, Bewitched, Get Smart, and Hogan's Heroes. Not a lot of those were that funny. I liked The Monkees because I had a crush on Peter Tork. All of them at one point. And it was funny and it was goofy and it was outlandish, but we were talking about Hogan's Heroes the other day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really wasn't that funny.
Well, I had a crush on Colonel Klink.
So I get it. Totally get it.
Right? Yeah, I love a man in uniform with a monocle.
Yeah.
Now, Get Smart was funny.
Get Smart was very funny.
Who was the creator of Get Smart? It was Mel Brooks and Buck Henry,
yep.
Right? And it was also daring, but, you know, in terms of hand-holding, compare Get Smart to Blazing Saddles, there was a lot more. And I'm not just talking about the G to PG content versus the R. The Blazing Saddles jokes, the Young Frankenstein jokes came much faster and much more furious. I do think it was a time of broadcast, and the important thing was to never leave anyone behind, and therefore the jokes couldn't be that daring. There was a watered-down process. But also, you know, by my calculations, during this time, there were, I don't know, 100 or 150 full-time comedy writers, TV comedy writers in the world. And now there are literally 10 times that amount. And you're just going to get a lot more quality when you get a lot more people into the pipeline.
Mike, if you look at the show that changed comedy the most, you'd be hard-pressed to find a show more than Saturday Night Live that altered our perception of what is and isn't humorous. But if you went back one generation to Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In and you watched those today, I hate to say it because I loved it when it was on, it doesn't hold up at all.
Yeah, I did watch Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In because after my article came out, people said to me, readers said, oh, those Muppet shows, those Muppet at the Dance segments, those were riffs on Rowan and Martin.
Yeah.
So, and I knew that abstractly, but I went back and watched. And what I would say is this. You have to realize that comedy is the thing that ages the worst out of all the art forms. You know, we could watch. There's some physical comedy and the Marx Brothers, that does well. But comedy that depends on, say, often clever wordplay, we don't understand what it is, and definitely comedy that riffs on current events, doesn't even have to be politics, just sort of things in the air, falls really flat. So if you watch the Rowan and Martin through that lens, I think it still scans as professionally done comedy.
Yes.
Like Goldie Hawn is still really charming, and Rowan and Martin still have pretty good shtick, and Artie Johnson, who just died, I mean, some of his impressions would be deemed politically incorrect.
Yes.
But there was something there that was legitimately professionally done and entertaining. But you're right. That was the vanguard.
Yeah.
And SNL, which came, you know, less than a decade later, you watch sketches from 1975, not all of them, but a bunch of them are fantastic. Now, it's funny, the sketches were a lot longer then.
Yeah.
I also got the season one DVD set of SNL. There were 7-minute sketches that didn't go anywhere in a weird way. So things have gotten tighter also with SNL, but you're absolutely right. SNL had more of the attitude of youth, and it still does.
Mike Pesca is our guest, journalist, host of Slate Magazine's daily podcast, The Gist, and just an all-in-all good writer. If you have any questions or comments for Mike or for Wendy and myself, 312-981-7200. A quick break and then more discussion. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. Mike Pesca is our guest. He's a journalist and host of Slate Magazine's daily podcast, The Gist. He's just written a great article called We're Much, Much Funnier Than We Used to Be. Boy, I hope that is true. Mike, how does attention span fall into this? You know, we suffer now from eroding attention spans. It's not what they used to be, where you can focus on something for a good long time. Everything has to be very quick now. How does that play into this?
Well, I've done some studies on attention span, or let me be honest, since I host the show, I've interviewed people who've done the studies, and what they actually say is that the attention span actually hasn't shrunk. It's just we can attend to material that's longer. We just choose to do it less, and also there's more choices. So what I think is the grammar of film, by which I mean how people understand the visual images, has changed, and it's gotten condensed. So it used to be, I was watching Crocodile Dundee, which wasn't from 1942, right? But to establish that you were in Australia, you see the establishing shot of the plane. Then you see the plane coming out on the runway. Then the person comes out on the plane, and then we understand, oh, this is a visitor from somewhere else. Now it would be smash, some guy shows up, and he's like, what's going on here? I'm from Chicago. What I'm saying is that it used to always be you needed so much more establishment and so much more hand-holding, and now things can become much quicker, and usually quicker is a friend of comedy. In fact, when people are funny, sometimes we just say, oh, he's very quick.
Yeah.
When you get a funny show, too, it puts the pressure on writers of other shows to be better. So I think that helps escalate the funniness for sure. There are some great comedies, Bill. You turned me on to Baskets.
Yeah.
And that is such an interesting form of comedy because at one point you're laughing hysterically, and on the other side of the coin, you're ready to cry.
I think that's absolutely true. I think a few things happen. One, it makes others up their game. But two, those kind of shows show, oh, funniness doesn't always have to be set up, punchline. And when you do that, you know, a show like Fleabag, which just won the Emmy, is funny, but it's also a lot of other things. And if you look at the shows that were nominated for the Emmy, they're fantastic, and they're a lot of them are weird shows. Russian Doll is a weird kind of show that is both funny but also kind of trippy. And The Good Place is funny, but it's also extremely philosophical and religious. And I just think that there's been an explosion of the quality of humor and the kind of humor that we can pursue. Now, the interesting thing is, happens at the same time, there's this bit of a backlash concerning, oh, you can't say that and you can't joke about that. And I tried in my article to figure out, well, how is it that we're funny, you know, much funnier, like I point out, but also a comic, quote unquote, crosses the line, and societally we say you can't do that. We try to rein him in. And I came up with sometimes there are two things going on in a society at once, and I think we're living in one of those times.
Let me throw this at you too, Mike. I've noticed that comedy, specifically on television, is much more unapologetic in that. You'll see a show, 30 Rock is a great example of this. On a weekly basis, there were a couple of jokes on a 30 Rock episode that were so obscure, the references were so obscure, and they would play on such a low margin. I know a lot of people weren't getting the references, but they would do it anyway. They would just plow through it and move on. You didn't see that in the older days of television, did you?
Yeah, broadcasting versus narrowcasting. Now, 30 Rock was on NBC, so it's a broadcast network, but it didn't have great ratings, and also, I mean, it should have. I love that show. And also, you know, if it had 8 obscure jokes a show, it also had, you know, 98 non-obscure jokes.
Yeah.
Talk about a joke-dense environment. 30 Rock was exactly that. And then, you know, Kimmy Schmidt, which is in many ways the cousin of 30 Rock, can't do that on Netflix. That's more, and NBC passed on that show, that's more an exemplification of the idea that, you know, there's all these different niches and all these different ways to do comedy. And if your aunt in Des Moines isn't going to get the joke, that doesn't mean it's a bad joke. Nothing against Des Moines. Lovely, lovely.
Right.
Does your theory hold up? Again, Mike's article is called We're Much, Much Funnier Than We Used to Be. And boy, I keep saying this. I so hope it's true. Does that hold up not just with television, Mike, but also with films and with novels and other sorts of media? Is it across the board that we're funnier than we used to be?
So we're, you know, our Twitter is much funnier than it was in 1972. I would say that
mine not so much. I'm getting bored with it.
No,
the same level. On my show, The Gist, I had a whole week, this article kicked off Comedy Week, and we did improv as a topic, you know, centered on Chicago, and we did late night, and we did stand-up, and then we did a whole show on film. And what we found out, and I talked to John August, who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and a lot of the Tim Burton films, and I talked to Dana Fox, who has written a bunch of great rom-coms, and I talked to Vanity Fair's critic, and here's where we came out. The actual film comedies that are called film comedies are still being made, and they're still out there, and definitely indie film has given us great comedies. But what's really happened is that all these other genres of film have taken on more comedy than a similar genre would have in the past. So some of the best comedy is in these superhero movies, right? So when Superman 1, I guess Superman 2 was a little funny, but when superhero movies first started coming out, they were either dark or serious, or there were action films, and maybe you could say they had a joke or two, but they weren't very funny. Now, that's some of the best comedy. Thor Ragnarok was probably the best comedy movie of that year. And there are so many other genres where comedy has kind of embedded itself like a virus. And it's a reflection, I think, on that if you want to show the world as it really is, you will have more people making good jokes. The audience will not only get on their side, but see them as recognizable. So I think a movie like Ordinary People or Kramer versus Kramer, right? Two great movies that I think there are very few lines that attempted something like funny. If those were remade today, there'd be some really truly funny scenes in them for the audience to connect to.
What I think is really cool is with comedy moving, evolving, and getting funnier, our kids are funnier. I think back of when I was in junior high and high school, I thought my material was A and was really good, and my friends as well. But now I have a 16 and 20-year-old, and they'll say something, and I actually find myself stopping and going, that was really funny. And Bill, I know your daughters are funny. It's like because of the evolvement of comedy, our kids are funnier.
My kids are 10 and 12, and they both have been doing improv for 3 and 4 years. My 10-year-old does stand-up. So, yeah, it's pretty
good. Excellent.
They're pretty fun.
I want to ask you really quickly about something you mentioned about the late night shows and their comedic presence. Don't you think that this was a perfect example of the more competition, the better? And for a long time, it was just Johnny Carson at night. Other people tried to go against him, but no luck. But now you've got so many options in late night shows, so many different avenues of humor, and that benefits everybody, right?
I absolutely agree with that. There are different tones. Imagine if So what is The Tonight Show? That's the show that Fallon hosts. But that is a way different tone than Kimmel's show and a way different tone than Colbert's show. And imagine if we were just, I don't want to say stuck. Some people like The Fallon Show. I prefer Colbert. But if that was the only form of comedy and you only had, you know, 12 to 15 writers on staff as opposed to the 100-something writers on all the cable shows, on all the late-night shows, it would be a much worse comedic environment. So you're right about that. And also, big credit goes to David Letterman because he was as influential a figure in comedy as anyone, as Lorne Michaels, as the guys from Monty Python, as Mel Brooks, as anyone we could think of.
I love hearing you say that because we're both Wendy and I are nodding our heads going, yep, that's the guy. He deserves the credit.
And if we're much funnier than we used to be, why do we still laugh at stupid juvenile jokes? Is there room for both? Because some of them are still funny.
I think it's wired into our hard consciousness. And we can't, you know, laughter is an involuntary response. And there is something about, I don't want to use the cliche of slipping on the banana peel, but there is something about the quote-unquote America's Funniest Home Videos that, you know, once the guy does get nailed in the nuts with the wiffle ball.
Over at theslate.com, it's great. And this article in particular, We're Much, Much Funnier Than We Used to Be, really does open your eyes. Mike, terrific job. I hope we can talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Mike Pesca from The Slate.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All happening right here at WGN. Do you have goosebumps?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Dean Richards will be on in a half an hour to talk about this new movie, Judy. I've been seeing clips from it. Renee Zellweger was on last night with Stephen Colbert talking about this new movie, Judy, where she plays Judy Garland in the latter stages of her life. You know,
you pointed it out yesterday,
yeah.
And I could not believe how much she looked like Judy Garland.
It's incredible.
I know.
It's incredible. Until last night, I saw, about a year and a half ago, they announced that she was going to play this role. And they've done other movie versions of Judy Garland's life. A couple of years ago, do you know who Judy Davis is? The Australian actress Judy Davis?
No.
She did a version. It was really good. She's a great actress. Before that, a made-for-TV movie with Andrea McArdle, where she played a young Judy Garland.
Boy, you know, you're just pulling these names out of years. Your hat.
Do you remember Andrea McArdle?
No.
She played Annie on Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's been done before. Parts of her life have been immortalized in film before, but Renee Zellweger just takes it to this new level. And I have to say, I never saw any similarities between the two at all.
None.
But last night, as she was on Stephen Colbert, there were a lot of similarities. There's a nervous energy to her, to Renee Zellweger, that I wasn't real aware of. And if you've ever seen clips of Judy Garland when she would do the late night talk show circuit, you know, again, toward the latter stages of her life, she was, I mean, I know a lot of it was drug and alcohol induced, but there was
kind of erratic behavior.
Yes.
But Renee Zellweger has immersed herself in the studying of Judy Garland.
Yep.
Is that perhaps why she's being
positive? Because I've seen her before not be this twitchy. You know, I know that sounds bad. I don't mean it to sound bad, but she seemed very ill at ease during the interview. She was pleasant and everything and certainly played along with everything, but she was very darty during the interview, much the way that Judy Garland was. So maybe, to your point, maybe when you just do immerse yourself for that long, it's hard to shake. You know, it's part of you.
I think Liza was more herky-jerky.
No question.
Judy.
Yeah. So what this brings up is, over the years, many actors and actresses have portrayed music legends, singers or musicians, and I'm trying to find out who has done the best job. Like, all right, so it's not fair to do to you because I thought about it quite a bit yesterday and today, but who stands out in your mind? Who has played a music legend that you've said to yourself, boy, I forgot I was watching that person. I thought I was watching the guy who was playing.
I have to say, and a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but I think Val Kilmer did a great Jim Morrison in the Doors movie.
He did, didn't he?
I really do.
Very good.
So that's one of them. I didn't see Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash.
That's one of my top three.
I got to watch that movie.
If I had to do a top three, that's number two. The movie is called I Walk the Line, and Joaquin Phoenix is always good. There's no question, but wow, was he good.
I can't wait to see him as the Joker either.
Yeah, I know. Let me throw a couple of other names at you. And if you want to throw out a candidate or two, please feel free. We're at 312-981-7200. The question again is, what actress or actor has played a music legend that you were swept away by how great they were? Rami Malek was my third.
I go back and forth. He had the mannerisms and he had the actions, but he looked more like Mick Jagger to me. I feel like they didn't really make him as Freddie-like as he could have been.
Oh, really? Yeah? Interesting. At any particular point or just overall?
No, through the whole movie.
Throughout, yeah. I understand what you're saying with the movements. There was a lot of Mick Jagger, but I always
I think he nailed Freddie Mercury's movements and everything,
yeah.
But look-wise, I couldn't get past that. He did a great job.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing, but
yeah.
He just kept making me think of Mick Jagger.
I wonder, though, if Freddie Mercury didn't have some Mick Jagger in his...
That's a good point.
Don't you think there
yeah.
could have been an element of that? All right, without a doubt, Rami Malek was, for me, the third of all the people I considered, and you already mentioned Joaquin Phoenix, number two. The person that I thought did the best job of playing a music legend that I've ever seen was Jamie Foxx in the movie Ray, where he was Ray Charles. Wow, was he good.
I saw parts of that.
I was spellbound by how
yeah.
good he was, mostly because I knew him from doing just
goofy
either
stuff.
Stand-up comedy or sketch comedy, and all of a sudden, it was so convincing that he was Ray Charles.
Mary wants to jump in. 312-981-7200. Hey, Mary, we're talking about people who have emulated a musical great. Your thoughts?
Gary Busey, I thought, did a great job portraying Buddy Holly.
He was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he's one of those loosey-goosey guys that isn't particularly good in everything, but he nailed it.
Yep, no question about it.
He was pretty good.
Mary, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Yeah, Gary Busey, on almost any day when you think about him, you're like, ugh, Gary Busey.
Nice sound effect.
That's a scary hombre right there is your Gary Busey. But when he gets something that's in his wheelhouse, and this was playing Buddy Holly, it was really good.
Oh, that was,
I enjoyed
him. Pretty good. Bill has called us at 312-981-7200. Anxious to talk to the listeners about this, aren't you?
Yeah, very much.
Hey, Bill.
Hi, this is Bill from Danville again. This isn't about an actor who portrayed a musician, but when Johnny Depp portrayed Hunter S. Thompson in the Fear and Loathing movie, it was eerily so close to how Hunter acted. And I realized that Johnny Depp actually lived with Hunter S. Thompson kind of before and during a little bit after the movie.
I'm always clouded, though, because I always think of Bill Murray in Where the Buffalo Roam playing Hunter S. Thompson, and I loved that version of him.
I did, too, and that was the first time I ever became aware of Hunter S. Thompson because of the Bill Murray and Peter Boyle movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Bill.
That. I love Fear and Loathing. That's a great movie. Cassie wants to jump in on this as well. We'll try and stay with music icons, mm-hmm. but we can go either way. Cassie?
Hey there. You guys are killing me. What happened to Sissy Spacek and the Coal Miner's Daughter?
Oh, yeah, She was Loretta Lynn. She was great.
She was fabulous.
I totally forgot
yeah,
about that.
She was amazing.
Yep. Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Cassie.
Okay, bye-bye.
And again, I wouldn't have thought Sissy Spacek looked anything like Loretta Lynn, but she did capture me and make me believe it.
Yeah. When you go back and you watch Joaquin Phoenix playing, he did such a good
Johnny
job,
Cash.
And I walked the line, yeah. Also, June Carter Cash in that is played by Reese Witherspoon, who I always thought was good, too. But in that one, I thought, wow, just to be able to hold up with Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal in that is no easy task, but she more than did it. She was really, really good in that, too. Who are your thoughts? Who comes to mind? Which actors or actresses have portrayed your favorite music legends? We're at 312-981-7200. You can call us or text us. More in a moment. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, Renee Zellweger will be playing the part of Judy Garland. What's the movie called?
Judy.
Oh.
Judy, Judy, Judy.
So you had posed a great question, and really the first person I thought of was Val Kilmer playing Jim Morrison in the Doors
movie.
Very
convincing. He really was.
Some listeners want to jump in, and I'm so mad at myself for not thinking of this one. Hi, Dave.
Hey, hi.
Who comes to mind, Dave?
Gary Oldman as Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy.
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
Yeah, he really was.
That was, like, for me, an introduction into punk, especially, you know, the British punk.
Yeah.
But when I saw that movie, I was blown away. I mean, Gary Oldman, his depth and just the way he did his character, I mean, it blew me away.
And Dave, remind me, I think at the time when Sid and Nancy came out, I don't think any of us had ever heard of Gary Oldman, right? He wasn't in anything prior to Sid and Nancy, was he?
Not as far as I know. I mean, that was, for me, the breakout of him as an actor. The movie came out in 85, and Sid and Nancy, the story took place in the late 70s.
Yeah, great movie and a wonderful portrayal. Agreed wholeheartedly. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
And a soundtrack to be enjoyed.
Definitely. And then Gary Oldman went on to portray Ludwig von Beethoven in 1994's Immortal Beloved.
He nailed it. I thought I was watching Beethoven when I watched it. Thanks, Dave.
All right, Jerry has called us. Hi, Jerry. What's going on?
You know what? This is kind of not exactly what you're looking for, because the actor I'm thinking of is a singer. You might have heard of Frank Sinatra.
I've heard of Frank Sinatra, yes. That's Frank Sinatra Jr.'s father, right?
Yeah. who was barred, who was thrown out of Condesa Del Mar, by the way, and Frank boycotted the place for years.
Oh, wow.
That's urban legend, but maybe it's true. But anyway, Frank Sinatra played a comedian in this. And once again, it's, he was an entertainer comedian. I think his name was Joey Brown. And it was called The Joker's Wild. And, I mean, he was spot on. Now, I always thought Sinatra was a real good actor. You know, he got a lot better the older he got as an actor because, you know, he wasn't the teen idol anymore. But this this Joker is Wild, if you watch it, it's just about some derelict comedian. And he was really good in that. If you get a chance, you know, try and see this movie. Sinatra was awesome in that.
The comedian you're thinking of is a guy named Joey Lewis, and I only know
yes.
this because I played him in an episode of The Untouchables, the TV series. So what happened was he was in trouble with the mob. He was a singer, and the mob destroyed his vocal cords,
oh
so he couldn't
God.
Sing anymore.
Instead of breaking a kneecap, they cut his
they
vocal
cut his vocal cords, and then he became a stand-up comic instead of a singer.
Is that why your voice is like
right.
that?
Yeah, that's the reason my voice is like this. Thanks,
you're right about Joey Lewis. And then one final note here. I don't want to keep it too long. If you ever get a chance... Thanks, Wendy.
Go
if
ahead,
you ever get a if you ever get a chance to watch The King of Queens and see Kevin James play Ralph Cramden...
Yeah?
Talk about a tremendous performance. He does Ralph, the tall black dude, Deacon. He does Norton, which is a little bit out of sorts. But his wife in there,
Leah Remini,
she does Alice Cramden. And I'm telling you, if you can ever find this episode of King of Queens with the Honeymooners on it, check it out.
All right.
This guy's spot on. All right?
Yeah, thanks so
Thank
much for
you,
the call.
Dear.
Thanks, Jerry.
Buddy O, pal.
Take care.
Too late. Stop sucking up. It's too late.
I mean,
you offended him.
It was too late to make this short. All right. Speaking of Frank Sinatra, and I know you didn't see this, 2003, The Night We Called It a Day, Dennis Hopper plays Frank Sinatra. I have to see that movie now.
I've never heard of that.
The Night We Called It a Day from 2003, Dennis Hopper plays Frank Sinatra.
Oh,
I gotta see that.
My curiosity. All right, I'm in.
All right, John has called us. Hey, John, what's going on?
Hey, guys.
What do you think, John?
I cannot believe you have forgotten this portrayal of the legendary musical icon played by John C. Reilly, Dewey Cox,
yes.
in Walk Hard.
Yes.
That is a great movie.
The greatest performance by a musical legend ever.
No, you're right. I can't argue it.
Thank you, John. You're absolutely
John.
Right.
All right. Take care, guys.
And let's talk to Donna real quickly. Hey, Donna.
Okay, that's me. Thank you. No, I just, when I heard this, I immediately thought of the movie A Song to Remember. The actor was Cornel Wilde, and the musician was Frédéric Chopin. That goes back many, many years, but so do I. And I'm wondering if I'm the only one who remembers this.
I love Cornel Wilde. I never saw this movie, but I'll look for it.
A
Song to Remember. It sounds interesting.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. How could we forget Angela Bassett as Tina Turner?
Oh, yes.
And Lawrence Fishburne as Ike.
Lawrence Fishburne was really pretty good, wasn't he?
Yes.
He really was. Very
Shame
imposing.
On us. And
Halle
LaBamba.
Berry, by the way. I keep thinking I should mention her. Halle Berry played Dorothy Dandridge in an HBO movie, and she was magnificent.
And La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips, Richie Valens.
Right.
He was really good.
Yeah.
And Jessica Lange played Patsy Cline in a movie, too. I didn't see it, but boy, I've heard great things about it. I have to see it.
No one's done a Jimi Hendrix movie yet, right? They've talked about it for years, but that hasn't happened. And no one's done a Kurt Cobain movie yet, but at some point somebody's going to play Kurt Cobain. That's inevitable.
And I think a special mention has to be brought up. Cate Blanchett playing Bob Dylan.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was the movie where seven or eight different people played Bob Dylan in different scenes, and Cate Blanchett was one of
them.
Yeah,
isn't that wild?
Yes.
Richard Gere, Ben Whishaw, Christian Bale, and Heath Ledger play the other sides
of Bob Dylan.
I'm not there.
The Nancy
I gotta
Walker
see it.
Segment is my favorite. When she played Bob Dylan, she was fantastic. Very convincing. all right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break.
You know what? We don't have a break.
We don't have to take a break.
So let's take one more phone call, and then we'll put this to bed. Hi, Tony.
How about Michael Douglas as Liberace?
On HBO a couple years ago.
That.
Wendy, he was fantastic.
Yeah. It was unbelievably cool. It was it was funny, and it was really cool.
And Matt Damon was in that as well, right?
Yes,
he played his friend.
It was kind of a weird, uncomfortable movie, but it was a cool movie. It was a great movie.
I totally forgot about that. Thanks so much for the phone call. You know who else was really good?
Thanks, Tony.
I know this one's it's of a different era, but when Tom Hulce played Amadeus. That guy.
Mozart.
Yeah.
He was really good.
He was great. He was so good.
I
know we're looking for guys a little more contemporary. And a couple people have sent this in, Wendy. Where is it? Tom Hiddleston, the British actor, played Hank Williams in a movie called I Saw the Light. And I just looked it up. There's a picture of him. I love Tom Hiddleston. He plays Loki in the Marvel movies. He's been in a bunch of good stuff. I had no idea such a movie existed, but the picture of him I'm looking at, he looks exactly like Hank Williams. I'll find that movie.
All right. And there is a Hendrix movie, All Is By My Side, John Ridley's movie. I don't know if it's out yet. Maybe it's not. It's the Jimi Hendrix story, and former Outkast singer Andre Benjamin captures
the
dreamy side of the rock icon.
Oh, I'm glad they finally, honestly, for 20 years they've talked about making that movie. I didn't know it actually happened. Kristen Stewart evidently played Joan Jett in a movie called The Runaways.
Oh, yeah, based on that band.
I'm not aware of that.
Who played Suzy Quatro?
I don't know who played Suzy Quatro. That's a great question. Jennifer Lopez getting some mentions. She played Selena.
Oh, yeah.
In the movie about Selena. I think that was the first time most of us knew of Jennifer Lopez, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, all very good, good answers. Great answers, every one of them.
All right, well, we look forward to talking to Dean Richards about the new movie, Judy. You do have to say it like that. Judy Pilak thinks it's about her.
I know.
Who's going to break it to her?
I'm not telling her. He knows which movies make you laugh and which ones make you cry. If you love films, then Dean's your guy. So grab yourself some popcorn. He will not talk about hard boys, Dean. Wendy, you know Dean Richards.
I love Dean Richards.
Everyone loves Dean Richards.
I remember when Anthony Hopkins played me in a movie.
Yeah, he did a nice job, didn't he?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, Jasmine called me a grandma, basically.
What?
Because I was talking about the Jimi Hendrix movie, All Is By My Side, which, what did I say? It came out in 2014, and I never heard of it. And I mentioned who played the lead of Jimi Hendrix, and I said Outkast singer Andre Benjamin.
Yep.
What did you say to me, Jasmine?
I never heard anybody say his full name. It was just funny.
Andre 3000, of course.
All right, you hep cats.
Wow.
I am just reading what it says here. I thought it sounded wrong, but I couldn't think on my feet. I think
either is acceptable.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dean.
If this were Jeopardy, Alex would have given you the points on that.
He's probably best known as the son of Andre 2999.
Plus, I couldn't remember if it was 2000 or 3000. So, whatever.
Right. Whatever. You're fine,
Andre Benjamin.
But I do stuff like that all the time, where an intern will go, "That's not right."
But to his credit, Anthony Hopkins, I thought I was watching you on the big screen.
I think he captured my essence.
Oh. You know who might play Wendy in a made-for-TV movie?
Who's that?
Beanie Feldstein.
Oh, now
she
would
talks.
Be perfect.
She'd be great as Wendy.
She would be good.
She'd be so good as
She's
you.
She's good in anything.
Yep, she is. Dean, the movie Joker has not come out yet. And
oh,
yet,
it looks so good.
But it's dipped in controversy.
Yep.
It is. It's bringing back the controversy regarding shootings of, you know, these loners who, you know, sit and fester, and the way that they take out their frustration and anger and hostility is by going to get a gun and just, you know, shooting up innocent people, which
yeah.
I have not seen Joker yet. So, but I'm told that that's part of this storyline, that Joaquin Phoenix
uh-huh.
Plays a guy like that, that goes out and just starts murdering innocent people because of his own inadequacies. And people are concerned that this will bring, you know, this might inspire people who have leanings that way, who have, you know, the possibility of being that way, is seeing it on the big screen, inspire them to actually go and commit a heinous crime. In fact, Joaquin Phoenix was doing an interview with a UK newspaper.
Yeah.
And the interviewer asked Joaquin Phoenix, if he had any concern that this might spark similar acts as a result of that. I can't believe Joaquin Phoenix walked out of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
He was flustered and he walked out of the interview. Later came back and apologized to the journalist who was doing the interview. But I can't believe that he never thought that that would come up.
That question? Well, he said he never even considered that an option. That why would that be a thing? If he's in a movie and he's playing a guy, why would that lead people to act violently?
Right, the Joker is not a nice guy in other movies, too.
Right. But this is particularly...
This is 2019. This is after church shootings and school shootings and all kinds of shootings where, you know, we learn that the profiles of the people who are doing the shootings are very similar to this particular character. And to think that it's never going to come up, I mean, I guess I'm just, you know, naive to think that somebody would go into an interview. It's like with, you know, my interview with Mel Gibson.
Yes.
In which he called me on air an a-hole.
Yes.
Because I dared to ask him if he thought that the controversy that he had been through for about the previous 3 years of allegations of domestic violence and anti-Semitic behavior and all kinds of very well-publicized, terrible behavior.
Yeah.
This was the first movie that had come out since all then, and these were the first round of interviews that he was doing. And for him to not... I asked him if he thought that his fans would still accept him as they did before.
Right. Fair question.
I could have easily made it a much, much more salacious question than that, but I thought that that was a fair question. And, you know, the result was him calling me an a-hole. And the fact of the matter is, did they really think that nobody was going to bring that up?
Right. It's too big to not bring up. You're not doing your job if you don't bring it up.
How are you in a movie like Joker, or how are you an actor who has got all this terrible stuff in your personal past, and you're sitting down to do an interview thinking that none of this is going to come up, that you don't prepare a one-sentence response? It doesn't have to be a big deal, but you have something prepared so you don't have to walk out of an interview or call the interview which is true, by the way.
Right.
He was exactly correct. I'm not
No one's debating
denying.
That at all.
I'm just saying it was an awkward moment for us all.
But it gave us a highlight on the 25th anniversary primetime special.
It sure did. Yep. Do you think the fact, remind me on this, it was one of the Batman movies where you had that Colorado shooting in the movie theater. Yeah. They were showing one of the Batman movies.
Aurora, Colorado.
So that adds into the background of all this to some extent.
That's part of what fueled all of this controversy, because theaters in Aurora, Colorado, where the shooting took place, for the Batman screening, they said that they were not going to show this movie, that it was, you know, still too sensitive of a subject for that community, and they weren't going to show it. Warner Brothers responded saying, you know, they're sorry to hear about their decision, that the movie in no way condones violence, you know, typical kind of corporate response. But, you know, and I'm not an advocate of, you know, censorship in movies.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, with where we are with random mass unexplainable shootings at churches and schools and places where you would never expect anything like this to happen before, I think you do have to be careful.
The other element is that some of the parents of the victims of that particular shooting have come out to say that they're uncomfortable with the subject matter of this film.
Yeah.
It's a PR nightmare for Warner Brothers, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, this movie was chugging along and getting 8-minute standing ovations at every film festival where it was playing. And now, you know, this is some mud that's been thrown on the movie, and I think it's mud that's going to stick around for a while. I don't know what the answer is to this. I mean, there certainly are plenty of movies with, crazy killers and, disembowelments and, you know, plenty of violent acts that I guess you could make the argument that if somebody was prone to become a murderer, that any number of movies might set them off like this. Maybe this one is just ringing a little too true of someone who is a loner, who, you know, feels like he's, that society has had their foot on his neck.
Yeah.
And the way that he retaliates is with violence. It's just uncannily truthful.
It's too close.
It rings very true to so many horrible, tragic news stories right
now. But, Dean, you can see, because I agree 100%, especially about the censorship and everything, but you can certainly see where a town, most specifically the parents of victims, would be so ultra-sensitive to something like this. I get that, and maybe if I'm Warner Brothers, I say I so totally respect it, we won't even push for it. We don't have to show it anywhere near that town if that makes you uncomfortable.
And it should be an individual decision whether or not a theater wants to run something, because otherwise there are going to be movies coming out that portray something that could happen in actual life, and then do we just not see them?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I agree. I mean, it's a tough question to answer. I think we need to be respectful of families who have lost.
Absolutely.
Especially young children.
For sure.
I think that needs to be a priority more than, is Warner Brothers going to make enough money with this motion picture? If people want to see it, they'll find a way to go and see it. If there's someone who's, prone to violence, I suppose they're going to find a way to see the movie anyway, especially, in a way. All of this controversy, I'm sure Warner Brothers is also loving, because it's got everybody talking about this movie, and people are going to be curious now. But you know what? If you're not respectful to people who have sitting in a church and worshiping and were gunned down by some, a crazy person who is mad at the world, or school children who were gunned down because somebody was mad at the world, maybe you need to reevaluate your priorities if that's the case.
So true. Dean Richards is our guest. We'll talk about the new movies coming out this weekend, most notably Judy. We're going to tell you all about Judy next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I'm sorry it's so late.
Miss Carl.
Oh, please. I'm Judy.
I'm very sorry, but your suite has been released.
What do you mean, released? Where exactly has it gone?
Your account was in arrears.
Clang, clang, clang with the trolley.
Mama, please don't go to sleep now.
No, leave the other one.
Zing, zing, zing.
The kids need a home, Judy.
I know what kids need. They need their mother.
You can't have the world's greatest entertainer out here without a drink.
Frank Sinatra's here?
Frank is great, but he is no Judy Garland.
I don't have a home. I can't even get a manager.
London would offer you a lot of money.
Talk of the town is desperate to do a deal with you.
You're saying I have to leave my children if I want to make enough money to be with my children?
I would very much like to stay.
Dean Richards is on. It looks so good. You saw
now,
Judy.
People who work on trolleys are complaining about this movie.
Clang, clang, clang.
People object to the clang, clang,
clang.
Oh,
clanging. No.
It's an unfair representation of the
trolleys.
Mom, what's a trolley?
This movie's going to give a bad name to moms everywhere. It makes me feel better about
it'll
myself,
though. It'll make borderline moms look fantastic.
Right. Poor Judy.
Yeah.
Poor Judy Garland. Renee Zellweger, who I guess most people recently know from the Bridget Jones movie, she took some time off to kind of get her own personal life in order, and she has come back with a roar in this film in which she plays the one-time 1930s child star, Judy Garland, who we know best as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, but she was in all the Andy Hardy movies with Mickey Rooney. She, as a teenager, was one of the biggest box office sensations. As an adult, it became a little bit more difficult for her to make that transition into being not only an adult star, but really an adult. She was, as if you believe all of the accounts, was so manipulated by the studios and co-stars, and everybody used and manipulated Judy Garland to the point where
her whole life, Dean, right?
Her whole life,
her entire life.
Really, you see flashes of this in this movie Judy that opens tomorrow, of her as a little girl on the set of Wizard of Oz. Being told to lose weight and to do this and to do that, and they're giving her pills to lose weight. And, she became addicted to pills and booze.
Yeah.
And as, as is the case with a lot of child stars, when they become older and they're not quite as cute and as adorable, it becomes more difficult for them to get jobs. It's even more difficult when you are one of the biggest stars in the world and you don't show up for work, or you show up for work and you're drunk. There are a variety of problems that led to Judy Garland becoming unemployable, destroying her personal life. She had three kids, and this movie really kind of focuses on the last years of her life, last couple of years of her life, when her children were taken away by their birth father. She had to try to make some money to try to get her kids back. The only place that she could get a job was at one of the biggest nightclubs in London, where she was still a smash. And the movie sort of focuses on that 5 weeks of Judy Garland's incredibly tragic, difficult, fragile life. And Renee Zellweger, I mean, she has clearly studied films of Judy Garland to get the voice pretty close, to get her mannerisms, her little hand movements, to get all of that down. She's got the look, the hair, the clothes, all of that is pretty much on target. But there's something about this movie that's just lacking to me. It's not bad. It's a good movie, and certainly if you've got memories of Judy Garland, and especially the later years Judy Garland, she was only 46 years old when she died. She was so young,
but she seemed so much older.
But she did. Somebody wrote that when she was 20 years old, she looked like she was 40, and when she was in her 40s, she looked like she was 70.
Yeah.
And that's true, because of the abuse of her body, the abuse of drugs, the abuse of alcohol. In fact, she died of a drug overdose. She apparently accidentally took the wrong drugs and died of an overdose of drugs. But the movie focuses in on the tragedy that were the last few years of her life. It's a good movie. I can think of other Judy Garland dramatizations.
The Judy Davis version
was, I think, much more powerful.
Yeah,
there was Renee Zellweger does her own singing in this movie, and I'm not sure that that's the best idea.
Oh,
it's okay. It's close, but when you're talking about one of the greatest singers and actresses of all time, it seems like the singing ought to be that way as well.
Yeah.
And to me, the singing fell short. And while the impersonation itself was fine, there needed to be something a little deeper here.
Yeah.
I thought. And it's good. It didn't rip my heart out the way that I thought a story about this poor thing.
Yeah,
should have been represented. So I wound up giving it a B minus.
Dean, what do you do with a story like this one where it's just tragic and then more tragic and then more tragic? Because usually in a movie you have to find gaps where there's some rays of hope, but there weren't any rays of hope there at the end of Judy Garland's life. So how do you balance that story out?
Yeah, there certainly were not very many rays of hope in her life. There are moments that are, you know, kind of funny. There are some lighter moments in the movie to sort of, balance things out in the film. But, you know, they also have to stay true to the story. And the story is not a good one. It's not a happy one
right
at all. I wonder how, I haven't heard if Liza Minnelli has seen this movie. She's virtually non-existent in this movie. When referencing Judy Garland's kids in this movie, they're mostly focusing on the three children that she had with Sid Luft.
Yeah, Lorna.
Lorna. There was another sister, and I think Jeff.
Joey.
Joey was the one young son. And your heart breaks the scenes where she still has custody of her kids. And, you know, she's out of control. She's taking pills, and the kids are watching. It just breaks your heart to see, you know, that happening. But the when she goes to London, and you know, she's really just kind of spiraling out of control, you get the facts of the story. I didn't really feel like I got the depth and emotion of what a horrible waste and tragedy that it really was. So liked it, didn't love it.
Yeah,
B minus is still, it's still good. If you're a fan, it's definitely worth seeing. You'll hear a lot of familiar songs, like the trolley song.
If you had to guess, despite the mixed reviews that it's getting, she's probably going to walk away with an Academy Award nomination, wouldn't you imagine?
So. Well, this is the kind of movie that Hollywood loves. Are you kidding me? It's a Hollywood icon.
Yeah.
It's a older generation star, of which most of Academy voters are older. You know, they're old white people. And, if Freddie Mercury could, get that much interest last year in portraying a real-life tragic story, this one's got all the potential for it as well. It depends on what else comes out this year as to whether or not You know, right now, I would say it's, you know, it's probably, you know, a leading nomination. If it does get nominated, it will, for an Academy Award. Cause I don't think I've seen anything better, that's come out, so far this year for, you know, leading female categories.
Right. Dean, thanks so much. We appreciate it. And we'll talk to you a week from today.
Bang, bang for your trolley.
Bang, bang for your trolley.
Thank you, sir.
That's how we now say goodbye to Dean. That's become a thing. All right. Coming up, the stories that matter with Ryan Burrow from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio.